Welcome to Stories from the Shadows. Tales from the golden age of ghost stories and supernatural fiction. I'm Mordell, and this week we will finish Lot 249 by Arthur Conan Doyle. Part 3. Hasty had branched off to his rooms with a few crisp and emphatic comments upon his friend's unsociability, and Abercrombie Smith crossed the quadrangle to his corner turret with a strong feeling of repulsion for his chambers and their associations. He would take Lee's advice and move his quarters as soon as possible, for how could a man study when his ear was ever straining for every murmur or footstep in the room below? He observed as he crossed over the lawn that the light was still shining in Bellingham's window, and as he passed up the staircase, the door opened and the man himself looked out at him. With his fat, evil face, he was like some bloated spider fresh from the weaving of his poisonous web. "Good evening," said he. "Won't you come in?" "No," cried Smith fiercely. "No, you're busy as ever. I wanted to ask you about Lee. I was sorry to hear there was a rumor that something was amiss with him." His features were grave, but there was the gleam of a hidden laugh in his eyes as he spoke. Smith saw it, and he could have knocked him down for it. "You'll be sorrier still to hear that Monkhouse Lee is doing very well and is out of all danger," he answered. "Your hellish tricks have not come off this time. Oh, you needn't try to brazen it out. I know all about it." Bellingham took a step back from the angry student and half closed the door as if to protect himself. "You are mad," he said. "What do you mean? Do you assert that I had anything to do with Lee's accident?" "Yes," thundered Smith. "You and that bag of bones behind you. You worked it between you." "I tell you what it is, Master B. They have given up burning folk like you, but we still keep a hangman, and by George, if any man in this college meets his death while you are here, I'll have you up, and if you don't swing for it, it won't be my fault. You'll find that your filthy Egyptian tricks won't answer in England." "You're a raving lunatic," said Bellingham. "All right, you just remember what I say, for you'll find that I'll be better than my word." The door slammed, and Smith went fuming up to his chamber, where he locked the door upon the inside and spent half the night in smoking his old briar and brooding over the strange events of the evening. Next morning, Abercrombie Smith heard nothing of his neighbor, but Harrington called upon him in the afternoon to say that Lee was almost himself again. All day, Smith stuck fast to his work, but in the evening, he determined to pay the visit to his friend Dr. Peterson, upon which he had started upon the night before. A good walk and a friendly chat would be welcome to his jangled nerves. Bellingham's door was shut as he passed, but glancing back when he was some distance from the turret, he saw his neighbor's head at the window, outlined against the lamplight, his face pressed apparently against the glass as he gazed out into the darkness. It was a blessing to be away from all contact with him, but if for a few hours, and Smith stepped out briskly and breathed the soft spring air into his lungs. The half-moon lay in the west, between two Gothic pinnacles, and threw upon the slivered street a dark tracery from the stonework above. There was a brisk breeze, and light fleecy clouds drifted swiftly across the sky. Olds was on the very border of the town, and in 5 minutes Smith found himself beyond the houses and between the hedges of a May-scented Oxfordshire lane. It was a lonely and little frequented road which led to his friend's house. Early as it was, Smith did not meet a single soul upon his way. He walked briskly along until he came to the avenue gate, which opened into the long gravel drive leading up to Farlingford. In front of him he could see the cozy red light of the windows glimmering through the foliage. He stood with his hand upon the iron latch of the swinging gate, and he glanced back at the road along which he had come. Something was coming swiftly down it. It moved in the shadow of the hedge, silently and furtively, a dark, crouching figure, dimly visible against the black background. Even as he gazed back at it, it had lessened its distance by 20 paces and was fast closing upon him. Out of the darkness he had a glimpse of a scraggy neck and of 2 eyes that will forever haunt him in his dreams. He turned, and with a cry of terror, he ran for his life up the avenue. There were the red lights, the signals of safety, almost within a stone's throw of him. He was a famous runner, but never had he run as he ran that night. The heavy gate had swung into place behind him, but he heard it dash open again before his pursuer. As he rushed madly and wildly through the night, he could hear a swift, dry patter behind him, and could see, as he threw back a glance, that this horror was bounding like a tiger at his heels, with blazing eyes and one stringy arm outthrown. Thank God the door was ajar. He could see the thin bar of light which shot from the lamp in the hall. Nearer yet sounded the clatter from behind. He heard a hoarse gurgling at his very shoulder. With a shriek, he flung himself against the door, slammed and bolted it behind him, and sank half fainting onto the hall chair. "My goodness, Smith, what's the matter?" asked Peterson, appearing at the door of his study.
"Give me some brandy."
Peterson disappeared and came rushing out again with a glass and a decanter. "You need it," he said as his visitor drank off what he poured out for him. "Why, man, you are white as a cheese." Smith laid down his glass, rose up, and took a deep breath. "I am my own man again now," said he, "but I was never so unmanned before. But with your leave, Peterson, I will sleep here tonight, for I don't think I could face that road again except by daylight. It's weak, I know, but I can't help it." Peterson looked at his visitor with a very questioning eye. "Of course you shall sleep here if you wish. I'll tell Mrs. Burney to make up the spare bed." "Where are you off to now?" "Come up with me to the window that overlooks the door. I want you to see what I have seen." They went up to the window of the upper hall, whence they could look down upon the approach to the house. The drive and the fields on either side lay quiet and still, bathed in the peaceful moonlight.
"Really, Smith," remarked Peterson, "it is well that I know you to be an abstemious man. What in the world can have frightened you?"
"I'll tell you presently, but where can it have gone? Now, look. See the curve of the road just beyond your gate?"
"Yes, I see you needn't pinch my arm off. I saw someone pass, I should say a man, rather thin, apparently, and tall, very tall. But what of him? And what of yourself? You were still shaking like an aspen leaf." "I've been within the hand grip of the devil, that's all. But come down to your study, and I shall tell you the whole story."
He did so. Under the cheery lamplight, with a glass of wine on the table beside him, and the portly form and florid face of his friend in front, he narrated in their order all the events, great and small, which had formed so singular a chain. From the night on which he had found Bellingham fainting in front of the mummy case, until his horrid experience of an hour ago.
"There now," he said as he concluded, "that's the whole black business. It is monstrous and incredible, but it is true."
Dr. Plumptree Peterson sat for some time in silence, with a very puzzled expression upon his face.
"I never heard of such a thing in my life, never," he said at last. "You've told me the facts. Now tell me your inferences."
"You can draw your own, but I should like to hear yours. You have thought over the matter, and I have not."
"Well, it must be a little vague in detail, but the main points seem to me to be clear enough. This fellow Bellingham in his Eastern studies has got hold of some infernal secret by which a mummy, or possibly only this particular mummy, can be temporarily brought to life.
and he was trying this disgusting business on the night when he fainted. No doubt the sight of the creature moving had shaken his nerve, even though he had expected it. You remember that almost the first words he said were to call upon himself as a fool. Well, he got more hardened afterwards and carried the matter through without fainting. The vitality which he could put into it was evidently only a passing thing, for I have seen it continually in its case as dead as this table. He has some elaborate process, I fancy, by which he brings the thing to pass. Having done it, he naturally bethought him that he might use the creature as an agent. It has intelligence, and it has strength. For some purpose, he took Lee into his confidence. But Lee, like a decent Christian, would have nothing to do with such a business. Then they had a row, and Lee vowed that he would tell his sister of Bellingham's true character. Bellingham's game was to prevent him, and he nearly managed it by setting this creature of his on his track. He had already tried its powers upon another man, Norton, towards whom he had a grudge. It is the merest chance that he has not two murders upon his soul. Then when I taxed him with the matter, he had the strongest reasons for wishing to get me out of the way before I could convey my knowledge to anyone else. He got his chance when I went out, for he knew my habits and where I was bound for. I've had a narrow shave, Peterson, and it is mere luck that you didn't find me on your doorstep in the morning. I'm not a nervous man as a rule, and I never thought to have the fear of death put upon me as it was tonight. My dear boy, you take the matter too seriously, said his companion. Your nerves are out of order with your work, and you make too much of it. How could such a thing as this stride about the streets of Oxford, even at night, without being seen? It has been seen. There is quite a scare in the town about an escaped ape, as they imagine the creature to be. It is the talk of the place. Well, it's a striking chain of events, and yet, my dear fellow, you must allow that each incident in itself is capable of a more natural explanation. What? Even my adventure of tonight? Certainly, you come out with your nerves all unstrung and your head full of this theory of yours. Some gaunt, half-famished tramp steals after you, and seeing you run, is emboldened to pursue you. Your fears and imagination do the rest. It won't do, Peterson, it won't do. And again, in the instance of your finding the mummy case empty, and then a few moments later with an occupant, you know that it was lamplight, that the lamp was half turned down, and that you had no special reason to look hard at the case. It is quite possible that you may have overlooked the creature in the first instance. No, no, it's out of the question. And then Lee may have fallen into the river and Norton been garroted. It is certainly a formidable indictment that you have against Bellingham, but if you were to place it before a police magistrate, he would simply laugh in your face. I know he would. That is why I mean to take the matter into my own hands. Eh? Yes, I feel that a public duty rests upon me, and besides, I must do it for my own safety unless I choose to allow myself to be hunted by this beast out of the college, and that would be a little too feeble. I have quite made up my mind what I shall do, and first of all, may I use your paper and pens for an hour? Most certainly you will find all that you want upon that side table. Abercrombie Smith sat down before a sheet of foolscap, and for an hour, and then for a second hour, his pen traveled swiftly over it. Page after page was finished and tossed aside, while his friend leaned back in his armchair, looking across at him with patient curiosity. At last, with an exclamation of satisfaction, Smith sprang to his feet, gathered his papers up into order, and laid the last one upon Peterson's desk. "Kindly sign this as a witness," he said. "A witness of what?" "Of my signature and of the date. The date is the most important. Why, Peterson, my life may hang upon it." "My dear Smith, you are talking wildly. Let me beg you to go to bed." "On the contrary, I never spoke so deliberately in my life. And I will promise to go to bed the moment you have signed it."
"But what is it?"
"It is a statement of all that I have been telling you tonight. I wish you to witness it." "Certainly,
said Peterson, signing his name under that of his companion. There you are. But what is the idea? You will kindly retain it and produce it in case I am arrested.
Arrested? For what?
For murder. It is quite on the cards. I wish to be ready for every event. There is only one course open to me, and I am determined to take it.
For heaven's sake, don't do anything rash.
Believe me, it would be far more rash to adopt any other course. I hope that we won't need to bother you, but it will ease my mind to know that you have the statement of my motives. And now I'm ready to take your advice and go to roost, for I want to be at my best in the morning.
Abercrombie Smith was not an entirely pleasant man to have as an enemy. Slow and easy-tempered, he was formidable when driven to action. He brought to every purpose in life the same deliberate resoluteness which had distinguished him as a scientific student. He had laid his studies aside for a day, but he intended that the day should not be wasted. Not a word did he say to his host as to his plans, but by 9 o'clock he was well on his way to Oxford. In the high street, he stopped at Clifford's, the gunmaker's, and bought a heavy revolver with a box of central fire cartridges. 6 of them he slipped into the chambers, and half-cocking the weapon, placed it in the pocket of his coat. He then made his way to Hasty's rooms, where the big oarsman was lounging over his breakfast, with the Sporting Times propped up against the coffee pot.
"Hello, what's up?" he asked. "Have some coffee?"
"No, thank you. I want you to come with me, Hasty, and do what I ask you."
"Certainly, my boy."
"And bring a heavy stick with you."
"Hello?"
Hasty stared.
"Well, here's a hunting crop that would fell an ox."
"One other thing. You have a box of amputating knives. Give me the longest of them."
"There you are. You seem to be fairly on the war trail. Anything else?"
"No, that will do." Smith placed the knife inside his coat and led the way to the quadrangle.
"We are neither of us chickens, Hasty," said he. "I think I can do this job alone, but I take you as a precaution. I'm going to have a little talk with Bellingham. If I have only him to deal with, I won't, of course, need you. If I shout, however, up you come and lam out with your whip as hard as you can lick, do you understand?"
"All right, I'll come if I hear you bellow."
"Stay here, then. It may be a little time, but don't budge until I come down. I'm a fixture."
Smith ascended the stairs, opened Bellingham's door, and stepped in. Bellingham was seated behind his table, writing. Beside him, among his litter of strange possessions, towered the mummy case, with its sale number 249 still stuck upon its front, and its hideous occupant stiff and stark within it. Smith looked very deliberately round him, closed the door, locked it, took the key from the inside, and then stepping across to the fireplace, struck a match and set the fire alight. Bellingham sat staring with amazement and rage upon his bloated face.
"Well, really now, you make yourself at home," he gasped.
Smith sat himself deliberately down, placing his watch upon the table, drew out his pistol, cocked it, and laid it in his lap. Then he took the long amputating knife from his bosom and threw it down in front of Bellingham.
"Now then," he said, "just get to work and cut up that mummy."
"Oh, is that it?" said Bellingham with a sneer. "Yes, that's it. They tell me that the law can't touch you. But I have a law that will set matters straight. If in 5 minutes you have not set to work, I swear by the God who made me that I will put a bullet through your brain."
"You would murder me?"
Bellingham had half risen, and his face was the color of putty.
"Yes." "And for what?"
"To stop your mischief." "1 minute is gone."
"But what have I done?"
"I know, and you know.
This is mere bullying."
2 minutes are gone.
"But you must give reasons. You are a madman, a dangerous madman. Why should I destroy my own property? It is a valuable mummy."
You must cut it up and you must burn it.
I will do no such thing.
4 minutes are gone. Smith took up the pistol and he looked towards Bellingham with an inexorable face. As the second hand stole around, he raised his hand and the finger twitched upon the trigger.
There, there, I'll do it, screamed Bellingham.
In frantic haste, he caught up the knife and hacked at the figure of the mummy, ever glancing round to see the eye and the weapon of his terrible visitor bent upon him. The creature crackled and snapped under every stab of the keen blade. A thick yellow dust rose up from it. Spices and dried essences rained down upon the floor. Suddenly, with a rending crack, its backbone snapped asunder, and it fell, a brown heap of sprawling limbs upon the floor.
"Now into the fire," said Smith.
The flames leaped and roared as the dried and tinder-like debris was piled upon it. The little room was like the stokehole of a steamer, and the sweat ran down the faces of the two men, but still the one stooped and worked while the other sat watching him with a set face. A thick, fat smoke oozed out from the fire, and a heavy smell of burned rosin and singed hair filled the air. In a quarter of an hour, a few charred and brittle sticks were all that was left of lot number 249.
"Perhaps that will satisfy you," snarled Bellingham, with hate and fear in his little gray eyes as he glanced back at his tormentor. "No, I must make a clean sweep of all your materials. We must have no more devil's tricks. In with all these leaves, they may have something to do with it."
"And what now?" asked Bellingham, when the leaves also had been added to the blaze.
"Now the roll of papyrus, which you had on the table that night. It is in that drawer, I think."
"No, no," shouted Bellingham. "Don't burn that. Why, man, you don't know what you do. It is unique. It contains wisdom which is nowhere else to be found.
Out with it."
"But look here, Smith, you can't really mean it. I'll share the knowledge with you. I'll teach you all that is in it. Or stay, let me only copy it before you burn it." Smith stepped forward and turned the key in the drawer. Taking out the yellow, curled roll of paper, he threw it into the fire and pressed it down with his heel. Bellingham screamed and grabbed at it, but Smith pushed him back and stood over it until it was reduced to a formless gray ash.
"Now, Master B," said he, "I think I have pretty well drawn your teeth. You'll hear from me again if you return to your old tricks. And now, good morning, for I must go back to my studies."
And such is the narrative of Abercrombie Smith as to the singular events which occurred in Old College, Oxford, in the spring of 84. As Bellingham left the university immediately afterwards and was last heard of in the Sudan, there is no one who can contradict his statement. But the wisdom of men is small, and the ways of nature are strange. And who shall put a bound to the dark things which may be found by those who seek for them? Join me next week on Stories from the Shadows for another spine-tingling tale of the unseen and the unknown.